You're listening to a podcast from the Journal of the American Association of Nurse Practitioners. I'm Kim Curry, Editor-in-Chief of the Journal. Welcome to Here's the Issue, featuring our April issue for the year 2021. In this podcast, I'll talk about some of the featured articles in this issue and include their abstracts so that you can consider what you want to read in more detail. Our first article this month is by Taylor Dinette and Cassandra Feltner. It's titled Hypertonic Saline versus Mannitol for the Treatment of Increased Intracranial Pressure in Traumatic Brain Injury. Here's the abstract. Background. Increased intracranial pressure, or ICP, occurring after a traumatic brain injury is associated with increased morbidity and mortality. If appropriate treatments are not initiated, brain herniation can occur and lead to death. Previously, the Brain Trauma Foundation recommended mannitol as the first choice hyperosmolar agent. However, in 2016, they retracted this recommendation, citing a lack of sufficient supporting evidence. Current research shows that hypertonic saline also decreases ICP. Objectives: to compare the efficacy of hypertonic saline and mannitol in lowering ICP in patients with traumatic brain injury. Data sources. A search was conducted up until June 1, 2019 using PubMed, Embase, CINAHL, and Web of Science. Selected articles compared mannitol and hypertonic saline in adults with traumatic brain injury with a measured outcome of reduced ICP. 4 meta-analyses, 3 randomized controlled trials, and 1 retrospective cohort study met the inclusion criteria. Conclusions. Hypertonic saline is an effective alternative to mannitol for increased ICP. 3 studies suggest hypertonic saline may be superior to mannitol. Conclusions were limited by sample size and methodological differences, such as varying concentrations and doses, and inclusion of patients without traumatic brain injury in their studies. Implications for practice. Evidence demonstrates hypertonic saline to be as effective as mannitol for ICP reduction. Further research and a large multicenter clinical trial is needed to compare these two agents for superiority in the management of increased ICP. Providers should consider the properties of each agent, adverse effects, and potential benefits when selecting a hyperosmotic agent. Next is a quantitative research study by Kara Young and Susan Calloway. It's titled Assessing Mental Health Stigma: Nurse Practitioners' Attitudes Regarding Managing Patients with Mental Health Disorders. Here's the abstract. Background. A contributing factor in the provision of suboptimal mental health care is the presence of stigmatizing attitudes among healthcare providers. Although numerous studies have investigated stigmatizing attitudes among physicians, nurses in psychiatric settings, and various populations of students, mental health stigma among nurse practitioners has not yet been addressed. Purpose. The purpose of the study was to assess NPs' attitudes and beliefs regarding working with individuals with a mental health disorder. Methods. A cross-sectional descriptive design was used. Nurse practitioners attending a national practice conference completed a survey for demographic and practice information and a standardized measure for assessing stigmatizing attitudes regarding 3 mental health conditions: anxiety and depression, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and substance use disorders. Results. A total of 141 NPs participated in this study. The most favorable attitudes were reported for working with individuals with anxiety and depression, and the least favorable attitudes were reported for working with those with a substance use disorder. Implications for practice. Stigmatizing attitudes are present among practicing NPs. Effective bias-reducing interventions are indicated to improve the patient-centered care NPs provide to individuals with mental health disorders. Our next feature is a qualitative research study by Miriam Boeri and Akjay LaMonica. It's titled Naloxone Perspectives from People Who Use Opioids: Findings from an Ethnographic Study in 3 States. Here's the abstract. Background. Naloxone is an opioid antagonist that can reverse an opioid overdose. Increased opioid-related mortality rates led to greater distribution of naloxone without a prescription and administration of naloxone by laypersons. This study fills a gap in knowledge of naloxone experiences among active users of opioids living in suburban communities. Purpose. The purpose of this study was to provide nurse practitioners with an in-depth understanding of current naloxone use practices among people who experience overdose events. The specific aims are to compare access to naloxone in diverse suburban towns, to examine administration differences across settings, and to understand perspectives on naloxone experiences from people who are actively using opioids. Methods. The data for this analysis were drawn from an ethnographic study in the suburban towns around Atlanta, Georgia, Boston, Massachusetts, and New Haven, Connecticut. Short surveys and in-depth interviews were collected. Inductive methods were used to compare data across settings. Sample. The sample included 106 individuals with a mean age of 41.3 years. Conclusions. Differences between study settings and access to naloxone, administration frequency, and delivery systems were found. Findings suggest more education and training is needed in overdose prevention and harm reduction intervention. Studies on delivery systems need to address the increase in fentanyl-related overdoses. Implications for practice. Nurse practitioners can help to target distribution of naloxone in local communities, facilitate collaboration with harm reduction services, and provide evidence-based education and training to laypersons. Next is an education feature by Laura Rivera and colleagues. It's titled Identifying Essential Clinical Skills and Procedures for FNP Students Using an Electronic Clinical Documentation System. Here's the abstract. Nurse practitioner education is designed to prepare graduates for competent entry-level practice. However, many new family NPs, or FNPs, report a lack of preparation in performing clinical skills and procedures. There is no approved list of clinical skills and procedures for FNP students. Further, there is a dearth of literature reporting clinical skills and procedures frequently performed by nurse practitioners to guide the nurse practitioner curriculum development. The purpose of this investigation was to summarize frequently encountered clinical skills and procedures reported by students enrolled in an FNP program from August 2012 through December 2018 at a Midwestern university, and to compare results with those found in the literature. After a comprehensive review of literature, a retrospective longitudinal assessment of clinical skills and procedures identified by FNP students and extracted from a proprietary electronic clinical documentation system known as e-logs was conducted. Comparison was made with current literature on clinical skills and procedures used by practicing FNPs. Overall, there was a consistency between clinical skills and procedures documented by students in e-logs and those found in the literature. Unique to this investigation was the frequent reporting of behavioral health assessments by students. Because behavioral health conditions are often first diagnosed and treated in the primary care setting, competency in care of behavioral health conditions is clearly a necessary clinical skill and procedure. Educators have a responsibility to prepare graduates for the skill set needed in the workplace. This includes a standardized set of clinical skills and procedures essential to FNP practice. Development of a universally accepted list of clinical skills and procedures will be instrumental in refining evidence-based nurse practitioner curricula that best prepares graduates with the experience and competence necessary to enter practice. Next is also an education feature, and it's by Garrett Matlick. It's titled Barriers Encountered When Exploring Nurse Practitioner Postgraduate Training Programs. Here's the abstract. With the increasing complexity of today's patients, the demand for nurse practitioner postgraduate training programs is growing. At least 70 such programs exist, yet information about the programs is limited. A sample of 52 program websites were investigated for information of importance to nurse practitioners, their employers, and NP faculty. Of the postgraduate training program websites studied, information regarding at least one of the elements investigated was absent from the program website. This lack of information availability makes exploring, selecting, or recommending a postgraduate training program difficult. As the number of programs and the number of graduating NP students continues to grow, the existence and consistency of information regarding new and existing programs will be increasingly important for the accuracy of prospective trainee exploration of such programs and for researchers interested in gathering consistent data. There are also three QI reports I'd like to mention this month. In the first one, Ernestine Olson, Sharon Frew, and Ruth Kleinpell were interested in a problem in a time delay in specialist care access, causing delays of over a month in efficient care provision in a rural South Central United States outreach clinic within a multi-specialty group associated with the hospital system. And they write about their approach to this problem and their investigation of it in an article titled Electronic Primary Care to Specialist Referral, a Pilot Project to Evaluate Referral Expedience and Efficacy. The second QI report I'd like to mention is by Julie Percival and Judith Butler. The authors were interested in a problem of screening mammography rates at a rural health center that were below state rates and a countywide rate of breast cancer above state and national rates. And so the authors write about their investigation and approach to that problem in an article titled Improving Mammography Through Effective Screening, Brief Intervention, and Referral to Treatment at a Rural Health Center. The final QI study that I wanted to bring to your attention is by Sarah Fincham, Todd Smith, and Janet Pereff. And these authors were interested in a problem in a college of nursing that had to do with educating healthcare providers. They recognized that educating providers is dependent on developing high-quality clinical preceptors, but yet preceptors face widespread challenges to precepting, such as time constraints and lack of formal training. So they wrote about their investigation and approach to this problem in an article titled Implementation of an Educational Program to Improve Precepting Skills. So those are three very interesting QI studies in addition to our other feature articles for you this month. I hope you enjoy this issue of the journal. Thanks to all of our listeners, and be sure and look for more podcasts from the Journal of the American Association of Nurse Practitioners. Thank you.